Well, welcome to News Talk, and this is D.G. Martin. Well, one critic said that to read Hal Crowther is like watching Michael Jordan dunk. Well, if you read Hal Crowther, as we do around here in the Weekly Independent of the Indy, or as people all over the country do in the Oxford American, you know what that means. And when Hal Crowther dunks, he dunks hard. And he's got a new book. It's called Gather at the River. It's a collection of his recent essays. The subtitle is Notes from the Post-Millennial. Is that say millennial?
Millennial
South. There's some words in there. Hal Crowther, welcome.
Great to be here, D.G. Good to see you.
Let me ask, and I want to start. Let me just ask you a mean question. Do you hold in greater disdain the Southerners like Trent Locke and Jesse Helms and some of our friends who have not put aside their Old South feelings, or that's number one, or those people who come from out of town or out of this region and come in and tell us that we should be ashamed of people like that?
Well, there's nothing more annoying to me, as I think this book and maybe the last one made clear, than people who come down here with stereotypes who don't understand at all what they're talking about. And the unfortunate thing about the media that gives most people their information is it concentrates on these sort of, you know, very vivid negatives. And I know this because my mother is a hardcore Yankee from Boston, and she lives in Chapel Hill now, but she had some misconceptions that you just wouldn't believe. That one thing that I reviewed in this book, the book review that was in the New York Times, that woman was saying things.
This is a book review of a young woman who took a trip through the South, kind of like a journey, and you were pretty hard on her, I would have to say.
So I was very hard on her. I mean, she said things like the word Mississippi makes her blood run cold. And, even to a lot of these people, when they think of a Southern Baptist, they think of a really ludicrous stereotype. Now, what if these same people could spend a half an hour, as we sometimes do, with Bill Finletter or Bob Seymour? Would it change, that particular stereotype in their minds? The problem is they know where to – they don't even know where to go to find the negative stereotypes except in the media. But if they were to come down here, they would have no idea where to look for the positive. And that's why our own critics are the best critics. There's no question that some Southerners are over-apologetic for things that we have done wrong and continue to do wrong. But it's only a Southern critic, someone who lives here long enough to know where the good, the bad, and the ugly are buried, who really has anything worth worth reading to say, in my opinion.
Well, it's kind of a throwback to an earlier time when, during the times of segregation, we blamed all of the discord among our people here on outside agitators. And to a certain extent, who did not understand the South and did not understand our customs and came down here and started telling us what to do. And I look back and say, if it hadn't been for these people who came down and told us some of these things where we were wrong, and they were outside agitators, but nevertheless, outside agitators sometimes have some thoughtful remarks that aren't pleasant to us. But wouldn't you concede that some out-of-town people can help us?
Yeah, well, these are activists, who kind of put their lives on the line rather than people, writing in the New Republic. I think there are maybe – I think I came up once with five different kinds of Southerners when it comes to race. They're the out-and-out vicious racists who I think are declining in number. And then there are the strategic racists, like many politicians, who use other people's racism in order to get their own ends. I think, Senator Helms is one of those. I don't know whether in his own heart Senator Helms is a racist, but I know that he has used racism for his own purposes. And that strategic racism is ugly. And then there are a lot of people who may be mildly racist, but they're basically apathetic, and they just sort of watch to see which way the wind blows. And then there's another group. That's a large group. There's another
Most of us characterize on every question.
That's a large number of people. But then there are other people who are actually just good people, who themselves have never done, you know, anything. But the best thing that they could do, they've never voted for people who use race. They're basically people who in their own lives, in other words, set a good example. And there's a lot of those. And then there are another, you know, same, you know, minority, a small minority on the other end, the people who are truly activists, who really take, you know, take steps and take risks to make, to create change. And there are always few of those.
Any of those, by way of illustration, is there anybody who's a hero of yours right now taking those kinds of courageous stands?
Well, there are a great many of them. I mean, they're usually people who, by the nature, don't become famous. You know, the people who always show up, like Jesse Jackson and so on, are kind of media figures with their own agendas and so on. But it's, you know, it's small town ministers and lawyers.
Like you mentioned Bob Seymour earlier.
Bob Seymour, of course, who's fought for these things all his life. And of course, Bill Finletter in Raleigh. But, you know, there are a lot of people like that who are not well known in every region in the South, you know. And they're, I think, Speak Now Against the Day, the book that by John Edgerton that came out a few years ago, talked about all the local people who fought for civil rights before the civil rights movement. Back when it probably meant that someone would try to poison your dog or burn down your house and so on. And he celebrated a great many people whose, you know, names are not familiar to us, but who deserved the credit that he gave them.
Well, getting back to my original question, which I want to tease you with probably throughout this interview, about whether you're further down on the outsiders who come in and criticize us or on those among us who deserve to be criticized legitimately. And maybe it's your introductory essay. It's called The Tao of Dixie, Stubborn
Tao,
People.
Yeah.
I'm studying Mandarin. I should be able to do that better. But you blame, and to some extent you put some of the responsibility for the misconceptions about the South on Erskine Cowell. And the truth is now that many people are listening to us right now, it's hard to believe, don't know who Erskine Cowell is. Will you tell us who he was, what he did, and why you think he's the source of some of these Yankee misconceptions?
Well, he was the best-selling Southern writer of all time by a margin of probably 10, 20 to 1. His books were published in every country in the world. Everyone was a bestseller in the United States. And the ones that people, you know, are most familiar
about
with.
About the time of the late 30s, early –
40s. Early 30s, 40s, 50s. Yeah, early 50s. And, you know, the most famous ones, I guess, being Tobacco Road and God's Little Acre, which was a film with Tina Louise and Burl Ives that I remember. But, I mean, they were they're pretty broad stereotypes. When you read them now, they don't stand up very well. They sort of pictured these dangerous, crazy, lusting rednecks kind of chasing each other through the tall grass, you know. And there's a lot of violence. And they did have sort of a social conscience. The heroes are sometimes, you know, labor leaders and things like that. So they caught on up north, not only because they made the South look like a bunch of libidinous guerrillas, but also because they seem to stand up for, you know, the working man against the mill owners and so on. So he became very fashionable. And, of course, his play, Tobacco Road, the play that was made from his book, was on Broadway for, I don't know, 8 years or something like that. And it was the single place all during the 30s, I think, and early 40s, where a New Yorker could, quote, learn about the South. And from my experience, both working in New York for a number of years and you know, talking to New Yorkers and dealing with New Yorkers and publishing since then, a lot of the damage that Erskine Cowell did has not by any means been erased.
What do you mean by the damage?
Well, I mean getting them to see Southerners in a very narrow spectrum of characters, almost comic characters. I think I mentioned that Jimmy Carter, when he was elected president, he was just immediately put in this kind of starched overall Sunday school teacher image, this kind of innocent, foolish guy, you know, who went to church on Sunday and spoke in platitudes and couldn't possibly deal with all the very subtle people who are running Washington, D.C. And, of course, the minute that people found out about President Clinton and his truly unruly libido, the fact that he was a Rhodes Scholar and a brilliant, sophisticated, well-read man, probably the most intelligent man, you know, neuron for neuron that we've actually had in the White House in our lifetimes. All of a sudden, you know, he was just this traveling salesman going from farm to farm, seducing the farmers' daughters. And those were Erskine Caldwell categories that were just sitting there in their minds, you know, ready to fit these men into.
And that is, even though Erskine Caldwell's work has been dormant for now 40 years.
Yeah, very much
but
so.
But the images in your mind still influence the way Northerners, particularly New Yorkers who are opinion leaders, see us.
Well, yeah, I don't want to, you know, beat this too hard because, as I confessed, I'm at least a half-breed, and when it comes to being a Southerner. And you know, but I did talk to a man who is now, I won't say his name because a couple of my friends are working with him right now. But you never know who's listening, D.G., you know, sometimes. But he is the editor of a major New York publishing house, and he also lived for years with one of my good friends. And I sat down with him about, oh, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago at the National Magazine Awards, and I just tried to get him to talk about Southern writers, living Southern writers. And this is a brilliant man. I mean, you know, there's no question about this. Other things that he's read and the things he's written, he's published books of short stories himself. The field was open. I mean, you could have Cormac McCarthy, Eudora Welty was alive then. I mean, you know, there's any number of people that he didn't have anyone on the tip of his tongue. I mean, in other words, somehow he'd managed to live in Manhattan all his life without really registering that anything serious was being written south of the Mason-Dixon line. I mean, I kept at it to make sure I wasn't wronging him. But the only one you could even mention, I mean, I was, of course, probably fishing for my wife, you know, to see if he,
well, everybody knows, or not everybody knows, that you're married to our favorite author, Lee Smith.
But the only one he could come up with was a woman who had written a kind of a, you know, middle brow, Wild Girls of the South book that he had edited.
Well, let's talk some more about that, but let's take a break first. I'm talking to Hal Crowther, Hal's new book, Gather at the River. It's full of essays about the South, about literature, about song, about politics, and we'll talk more about that with him after this short break.
You've been noticing the signs for a while: roughness, wrinkling, irregular pigmentation, or inelasticity. These are all normal changes in our skin as we age. This is Dr. Lori Etter of Central Dermatology. As we grow older, our skin doesn't produce new cells at the same pace. Here are several tips to enhance skincare as you grow older. Use skincare products that nourish your skin cells, such as creams and lotions with ingredients like vitamin B complex, copper, and flax oil. If you smoke, stop. Ask your doctor or skincare specialist about other topical products that can help maintain and protect your skin's health.
For medical or cosmetic questions about your skin, call Central Dermatology Center at 401-1994 or click on www.cdcskin.com. Central Dermatology is located on Highway 54 near the I-40 Exchange. Central Dermatology, protecting what protects you.
This is Kit Ballew of Franklin Street Realty.
And I'm Sammy Martin. You know, Kit, a lot of people look at January as the off-season for real estate, as a time when nothing is really going on.
As in sports, it's what you do in the off-season that can make or break you. At Franklin Street, we're already helping our clients get ready.
And as any of our agents will tell you, that season starts in January, not in March.
No kidding. If you're going to sell your house this spring, you don't want to wait till spring to do all the things that might need doing to get the best price for your home.
At Franklin Street, while not certified feng shui specialists, we do know how to make your home look its best.
We'll get whatever you need, painters, carpenters, landscapers, or just strong backs, and storage units to hide that 30-year-old recliner that no one really needs to see.
You're talking about a chair, right?
Yeah, Sammy. Look, we could go on and on about what our agents do best. Why not go to our website at franklinstreetrealty.com and see what and who we have to offer?
Or call Franklin Street Realty at 929-7174.
Why would you call anyone else?
Good morning, Aubrey.
Good morning, Ron. You got a good joke for us today?
I do, and this is one of my own.
Uh-oh, I'm scared. Let's hear it then.
A horse walks into a bar, and the bartender says, "Why the long face?"
Oh, no. That was bad.
Please help Ron Stutz by sending us your clean jokes. The Molly Made Clean Joke of the Day is read every morning at 7:50 a.m. So not only will you receive recognition for being hilarious, but you'll become eligible to win a $100 gift certificate good for Molly Made House Cleaning, Molly Made Carpet Cleaning, or Mr. Handyman Services. Not too shabby, huh? So go ahead and send us your jokes to cleanjoke@wchl1360.com. That's cleanjoke@wchl1360.com.
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin can be heard once again Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Hal Crowther. We're talking about his brand new book published by LSU Press, Gather at the River, Notes from the Post-Millennial South. And Hal, you're, as you mentioned, you called yourself a half-breed, but you're not altogether a total native son of the South.
Well, again, are we on the air yet? It's a long pedigree, but my father's family's from near Greensboro, and I lived in naval bases in Charleston and Norfolk when I was a child. Had never lived in North Carolina until I came back here and got a house when I was, I think, 33, 34. But I've been in the South a good deal more than half my life, and half my relatives are Southern, so... I think that qualifies me
in some people's books. It qualifies you, and sometimes around this place, you got to have been born here to have any chance at all.
Well, you know, John Reed, who defined Southernness for Southerners, was born in New York City. So, the same reason that I was born in Canada, because our parents were both officers.
All right. Well, you're taking me back to this original question I asked you earlier: is to what degree do we give respect to outside viewers and commentators of Southern life? And you mentioned John Sheldon Reed, who says he didn't really understand that he was a Southerner until he was away from the South. That
right.
That only with some distance, or only by having some distance, are you able to understand as well as you might who you are and where you came from and what's special about what you came from. And do you agree with that?
That's absolutely true. When I was a kid, particularly when I was living in West Virginia, I thought that mountain music, you know, the string bands was what the farmers were listening to, and I was just dying to get move on, you know, to jazz and things that, you know, that educated people listen to. And then I don't know, years later in college, Doc Watson did a concert, you know, up in Massachusetts, up in the Berkshires, and I listened to that music and I knew right away who I was, you know, in a certain way.
Well, let me.
A hillbilly. I'm almost more of a hill. I'm more of a legitimate hillbilly, even than I am a real Southerner, I think.
Well, it's one of your one of the people you talked about in your essays. You liked the term hillbilly if it wasn't being used in a taunting way against him.
And absolutely that's, right.
Before the break, you were talking about a guy in New York who's ahead of a publishing venture, edits books, writes books, and yet was unable or unwilling to concede to you the special and quality of Southern writing, its impact on the rest of the country.
He couldn't really name a Southern writer.
And why couldn't he name, for instance, Thomas Wolfe?
Well, I just asked him, I guess, to say who his favorites were, who he read.
Yeah,
and that was when he failed to come up with any.
He couldn't come up any that he was reading.
I'm sure if he took a recognition test, you know, who wrote "Look Homeward, Angel," he has a degree from Swarthmore. I'm sure he could have done it, but he didn't have anyone on the tip of his tongue. It wasn't something that he read for pleasure or thought about seriously. Apparently,
well, you got an essay about Thomas Wolfe, and so I want you to talk a little bit about it. But maybe as you talk about it, you can weave in an answer to this question, which I think haunts us a little bit, and that is, not only are we regionally proud of Southern literature and Southern writers and have some idea that we believe these are special writers, but here in North Carolina, we believe that our state is maybe something special in compared to other states in the South because of the writing community that we have, which you're a part of. Centered in Hillsborough, but not just there. So what is it about Thomas Wolfe that continues to intrigue us. Was he a great writer? How does he stack up? And is he the greatest of North Carolina's modern day or last writers in the last 100 years?
Well, I tried in a certain way to rehabilitate his reputation, I think, you know, which suffered from that same kind of stereotyping. He was a kind of a huge unruly man, and he submitted huge unruly manuscripts. And he was almost, I think, his size and his general appearance caused certain Northerners not to take him as seriously as they might have. And I think that the first essay in my last book was about James Dickey, who suffered from some of the same. They were both also people who often behaved badly in a social,
get a little
in a drink social
in their head.
Setting. Yeah, but of course James Dickey was an absolutely brilliant poet, although not a person you would really want to have living in your neighborhood or going out with your sister. And Thomas Wolfe was this absolutely brilliant man who had practically memorized half of Western literature. And that's not the image that you got when you read what Eastern Northern critics were saying about his work. Some of them appreciated him a great deal. But over the years, certain critics have kind of said, well, this is rough stuff, you know, this is not very well shaped. This is a man with no discipline. This is literature for passionate adolescents and so on. And when you read, you know, you go back and read Wolfe, there was just an incredible spirit there, just a kind of a grasping for life, you know, clutching life with both hands and kind of pouring all that he felt into his work. And you just don't find that anywhere anymore. And there were also these wonderful tone poems where he would just go off, and you could hardly take a deep breath for about a page and a half. You know, you were just mesmerized by the language and by the passion and so on. And they're unforgettable. And I think a lot of people don't read primary texts anymore. In the last few years, this is another one of my favorite beefs, but it fits in with what a lot of my friends have told me who teach English literature, that all this theory came in and people had attitudes toward certain kinds of writers, particularly big, bumptious, loud, heterosexual writers like Thomas Wolfe. They were dismissed without being read.
Oh, come on now.
No, this is absolutely true. Franklin Trickey wrote an article in Lingua Franca trashing the graduate students at Duke a few years ago, saying that these people are reading the theory and not the texts. They have not read the book. They have attitudes toward Thomas Wolfe, but they haven't read Thomas Wolfe. And I just thought that, you know, that Thomas Wolfe was really due for a little rehabilitation. I think it was the 100th anniversary of his birth.
Well, I'll ask you again the question about the special.
I think I call them a great literary force field more than a great writer.
Yeah. And I want you to comment further, because when we say to folks who live in Mississippi that we have a great tradition of literature and a currently active group of writers in North Carolina, they raise their eyebrows and they say, have you ever heard of William Faulkner, Dora Welty? They start throwing names out at you. And so it leads to the comparison between our champion, it's kind of like David and Goliath, our champion Thomas Wolfe versus Mississippi's champion William Faulkner. And are we in the same category?
Yeah, there's no need to do it that way. I mean, they were both kind of undisciplined and sprawling in many ways. I mean, Faulkner, even if you read all his books, which I think I have now, amazingly repetitive. I mean, he recycled, I wouldn't say necessarily the same paragraphs, but the same ideas and the same sort of relationships and the same, conflicts would be recycled mm-hmm. through different books. And Faulkner, at a certain point, you know, was also dismissed by most critics as being undisciplined and out of control and occasionally brilliant but often irrelevant, et cetera, et cetera. And a critic named Malcolm Colley, a Northern critic, rehabilitated Faulkner's reputation and was probably largely responsible for him winning the Nobel Prize. He sort of took all these books and put them in order and showed what there was, you know, the best of them, what there was to admire and so forth. I mean, reputations are always very much at the mercy of trends, you know, both in the university literature departments and whoever might be writing criticism for the influential journals. And that changes. I mean, it fluctuates very much. One time, Herman Melville was completely out of fashion. No one was reading him or paying any attention to him. He had disappeared. And then certain critics took him up, and the next thing you know, he's considered to be the number one American writer who ever lived. And at one time, no one read him at all.
Is there anybody in American life, American literary life today, who would have enough influence to take a writer who is underappreciated and single-handedly take him, as you did or attempted to do with Thomas Wolfe, make him a better appreciated figure and get him into the college courses? Who does that today?
Not really. And that's a really good point, DG. You know, when I was reading a biography of Edmund Wilson. At one time, critics, sort of public critics like Mencken and Wilson, had this enormous readership. And even to a lesser degree later, people like, you know, Alfred Kazin. But, I mean, they had this enormous readership, at least among educated people, among literate people. And they did have the power to change mm-hmm. reputations in a very short time. And I would think today there would be no one.
I noticed when
possibly, you know, something in poetry, maybe someone like Charles Simic, who writes these essays in the New York Review of Books that are probably read by almost everyone who reads serious poetry. But in
both of them.
Yeah, well,
no, I'm sorry.
There's a problem.
The problem of reading. Now, I take that back, and I wish we could edit that out. That was not.
But, it's your show.
No,
you can edit out anything
no,
you
I
want.
Can say whatever I want to, but it is true that, and I worry about this with all kinds of writing. That, and you made this point in your in one of your essays in this great book, Gather at the River. You said we're moving towards a point where there are going to be more great writers than there are readers to read them. Do you remember saying that?
Yeah, I remember saying that. Mm-hmm. I remember I think it was Richard Ford, but I'm not absolutely sure. Something that Richard just said at eating lunch one time. He said, you know, there are probably only about 2,000 or 3,000 really serious readers in the United States. And he said, if you go around on these book tours and you do these book signings for 4 or 5 years, you met half of them.
Well, yeah. I mean,
he meant it.
There's something to that, and it's reflective of what has really happened, I think, in poetry, in the sense that the best appreciators of poetry are folks who are writing poetry themselves, and they appreciate each other and they bounce off each other. And then there are others who are reading poetry who get a lot of pleasure out of it, but not the way it used to be when people would break open the magazines to see what different poets were writing.
Well, it's changing. You know, literacy is changing for the worse, of course. But I don't want to get into any sort of anti-populist things. It's probably unfortunate that the most powerful person in literature today in the United States is Oprah Winfrey. And I understand now that Garrison Keillor has taken to anthologizing poetry, which is sort of, you know, Garrison's favorite. And since Garrison is, you know, a celebrity with a great deal of influence, I suppose quite soon Garrison may be that person who can change tastes in poetry and put some people on the map and take other people off it. We live in an all-celebrity, all-the-time culture.
Yeah, that's interesting, but it does say something about us as readers and that we are followers looking for a leader, looking for somebody to tell us what we ought to read.
Exempt me from the we.
Yeah, I will. And we'll take you. No, that you're absolutely right. We will exempt you from the we. But the rest of us are looking.
Too much so, I'm afraid.
Let's take a break. Hal Crowther, and I'll be right back.
East West Partners presents Bob Woodruff, president of the Cedars of Chapel Hill.
You've probably heard about the Cedars from friends who live there or are thinking about moving there. We're pleased to announce that Phase 2 homes are going fast. And if you want a new home in the country's premier continuing care retirement community, you need to act now. Give us a call at 259-7929 and come take a look. No obligation, just an opportunity to meet some nice people and see what people are raving about. We'll throw in lunch or dinner and even overnight accommodations in one of our Cedars homes. And you don't have to be from out of town to take advantage of the overnight stay. If you've wondered what it would be like to live at the Cedars, come spend a night with us and enjoy our amenities and fine dining. Call us at 259-7929. At the Cedars, life has been good to you. Now, it gets even better.
The Cedars of Chapel Hill is an East-West Partners community.
Hey At News Talk 1360, WCHL, our programming sometimes raises eyebrows. While people can be polarized in their political beliefs, there are a few things that always bring people together. One of these things is good food. When Stephanie Miller came to town, she visited a local restaurant that truly is a political uniter.
Listen, if you're listening in Los Angeles or Seattle or somewhere, you have a long drive, so I would get going. 411 West. Is a restaurant in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and I suggest you take your family there, particularly if they're Republicans, because the food was just orgasmically good, wasn't it?
It's all unbelievable.
Yeah, we tried the steak, the salmon, the chicken. I'm just telling you.
I love what she's having.
No matter where you are in the United States, I suggest you start driving now. It was
spectacular.
Yeah, it was terrific. So we'd like to thank everybody that came out to see us in North Carolina. We had a heck of a time.
We are lucky to live and work in a place that offers a table for friends and neighbors from all walks of life and with differing opinions to get together and celebrate our differences. The Chapel Hill Restaurant Group reminds you to support your community and dine locally. Remember the days? Beatles, Woodstock, thinking it was cool to have the music as loud as possible? Loud music was a choice then, but now it's a necessity.
This is Jerry Hatfield Marang. Hearing loss is typically associated with getting older, not damage to the ear. More and more baby boomers in their 40s and 50s are experiencing hearing problems. Many cases of hearing loss among baby boomers can be traced to their youth when they listened to rock bands or played in them. If this sounds familiar, call Hatfield Marang Hearing Aid Center today.
Hatfield Marang Hearing Aid Centers. They have 6 locations, one in the Glen Lovick Shopping Center to serve you. Call 968-8232. That's 968-8232. Hatfield Marang Hearing Aid Center. You'll like what you hear.
You can hear D.G. Martin with a replay of Who's Talking from the whole week, Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360. WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Hal Crowther's got a new book of his essays, Gather at the River, Notes from the Post-Millennial South. And I'm talking to him about it. Great series of essays. Hal, I probably won't get to ask you this if I don't ask you right now, but tell us about where these essays came from. Some of them I read before in the Independent, or maybe some of them have been other places.
I don't think any of them have been in the Independent because for the last few years I've been kind of focusing, because of syndication, on politics and, you know, even more national than regional
politics. So these would be more likely from the Oxford American?
Only about half of them, I guess. Uh-huh. And the others are spread out from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. There's one from the New York Times. There's a couple that were published in journals, university journals. Creative Loafing in Atlanta.
Oh, yeah.
A number of different publications. But a lot, about, I'd say 40% maybe from the Oxford American, which was out of business part of the time.
One of the things I missed in the and this is by way, I guess, of criticism of the book, but only to say that I might be asking you some questions in the sense – that there was no specific identification of it, what at point in time or for whom you were writing the essay. And it led me to think, did Hal take these, or to what extent did you take them and rework them, or did you feel a commitment just to publish them as they were?
I always go back over them and you know, take out things that seemed too topical, that were, you know, of the moment. But the Oxford American being, you know, bimonthly, always lends itself to sort of a longer view.
More reflective,
anyway. Very few of these are anything like, of course, the longest one in there was my Mencken lecture in Baltimore three years ago.
It's your concluding essay.
A long essay that was written, to be read in front of the Mencken scholars in Baltimore. And I think there's another one that was a speech that was printed in Southern Cultures, a speech that I made at the North Carolina Museum. So there's a really wide range of things. But they were all from the last 4 years, I think, things I did the last 4 years about the South. And they were encouraged, a lot of these pieces were, by John Grisham and Mark Smirnoff, who said, you know, well, you're always tearing people to shreds, and we'd like to know what you like. You know, are there...
Oh, really? Now, oh, that's great. So I mean... some of your great admirers have said that you carry some kind of sharp weapon. I can't remember what.
Pat Conroy said something about a shotgun, and someone else talked about a knife. But I think, Tommy Tomlinson, and I think in the Charlotte Observer said this boy will cut you.
Yeah, in fact, it's on the he says, thank the Lord for people like Hal Crowther. He is the rare voice in the choir that is not only loud but can carry a tune. But don't you get the feeling that Crowther is happiest with a straight razor in his hand?
A straight razor, right, that's right.
Don't get him mad. The boy will cut you.
I like that review. That was
cool. It is true. So I got to ask you. You say that the Oxford American and John Grisham, who took an interest in that magazine, encouraged you to talk more about the things you liked than the things you wanted to cut up. But I wonder if maybe you're getting old and mellow and more comfortable with being nice in your writing than you used to be when you were just carry that razor.
Well, this is entirely possible. I mean, to answer that very seriously, when I first came, back down here to North Carolina, I was writing in the Spectator. I had been the last couple of jobs that I'd had. I was writing for news magazines. Where you are edited so sharply by different layers of editors, and I felt that my wings had been clipped, and suddenly I was permitted to say whatever I pleased. And I'd also been writing some television in L.A. and so on, and that made me feel just a little bit like I'd been prostituting my wondrous talent. And it's true that I was more than outspoken, during the Reagan administration and back in the early 80s. And I was just enjoying the language and the freedom tremendously. I think that I have always had a lot of things that I believed in that were positive. I think I've always been actually sentimental in a certain way towards certain things, like music and Southern women and dogs and, baseball and a lot of things that show up in these books. But I'll tell you the truth, DG, as I get older, particularly the essays that I syndicate, it seems to me there aren't enough voices that are still indignant and well-informed and more or less independent, that don't, adhere to a party line on one side or the other, but are just kind of waiting with their straight razor for people to lie and cheat and fail, which has happened so much, with our government recently. There needs to be a certain number of voices. And if I thought there were enough voices, enough eloquent, independent, adequate voices, I would love to go back to writing about dogs and baseball. It's a long answer to your question. I suppose I am less combative and bloodthirsty than I was a few years ago. I'm 60 years old, and it's been a long fight, And unfortunately, at this moment in time, there are more things to fight about, in my opinion, than there were 10 years ago or 20 years ago.
Well, let's take a break and come back and talk about some of them. Mm-hmm. Talking to Hal Crowther about his new book, Gather at the River, and we're also talking about some of his other work, and he and I will be right back.
WCHL 1360, time now for Biography for Radio with Jack Perkins, brought to you locally by the Cedars and East-West Partners community.
She arrived at the train station ready to help the wounded. She was horrified by what she saw. Her story next on Biography for Radio.
I'm here with two adorable five-year-olds.
Hi.
Chances are that one of them doesn't get the calcium they need for optimal bone growth. In fact, 50% of kids don't get enough calcium. That's why Nesquik is one of the best choices you can make for your kids.
Wow, Nesquik? Can I have a
specially
glass?
Fortified with vitamins, minerals, and 33% more calcium than milk alone, it's the delicious way to help them get what they need. Nestle Nesquik, helping build strong bones for life.
The train depot in Culpeper, Virginia was filled with wounded soldiers. Doctors in blood-stained gowns were amputating shattered arms and legs with no anesthetic and tossing the limbs in a pile. It was a filthy end for the Union soldiers who had survived the battle at Cedar Mountain. The 40-year-old clerk suppressed her horror and set to work, preparing food and bandages. For the remainder of the Civil War, she worked tirelessly after convincing officials to allow a woman on the battlefield. Once, she extracted a bullet from a soldier's face with a penknife. Another time, she was almost shot. Her nursing experience was looking after her brother after a bad fall. But she brought such comfort to soldiers, she was called the Angel of the Battlefield. After the war, she visited Europe and observed the work of the Red Cross. When she returned, she fought to convince Congress to sign the Treaty of Geneva that had led to the charity's formation. Despite doubts about letting foreigners meddle in American affairs, she finally got her way. In 1881, the American Red Cross was born, thanks to the determination of founder Clara Barton. For Biography, I'm Lawrence Scott.
Biography is a trademark of A&D.
Biography for Radio, brought to you on WCHL by The Cedars of Chapel Hill and East West Partners Community. The Cedars is the country's premier retirement community. Call 929-1995 to find out more on this very special community. Life has been good to you. Now it gets even better at The Cedars of Chapel Hill.
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin can be heard once again Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. Hal Crowther and I are talking about and around his new book published by LSU Press, Gather at the River, Notes from the Postmillennial South. And Hal, you were explaining to us that you still carry your straight razor, although you maybe not with the same degree of enthusiasm that you did when you were younger.
I do it out of duty.
Out of duty. What are the things that most worry you about where we are as a country and a state and a region and as a community here in Chapel Hill and Hillsboro? What's on your mind is things that you feel obligated to comment on?
Well, first of all, you know, the media is in free fall, you know. I mean, this is the newspapers are reaching the point now where they're being asked to show such a large profit that they're cutting down their foreign bureaus, they're eliminating all kinds of jobs. The biggest newspapers, the Los Angeles Times, has just been stripped. And, of course, its former editor, John Carroll from Raleigh, resigned as a result of a couple of years after he'd won four Pulitzer Prizes. He was forced to resign because they were cutting his staff. The New York Times is cutting staff. Time Magazine is gutting their editorial operations. Let's face it, print is in decline. And for many years, broadcasting has been derelict in its duty as far as news and information goes. It's become more entertainment than information, and what information they provide is rudimentary and, you know, basically surface and secondhand and of very little value. And over the last few years, you may have noticed there are more and more foreigners that are cropping up on your screen because they're paying people from other countries, you know, by the word, because they are no longer willing to support foreign bureaus. And the tradition of the foreign correspondent, which is what I wanted to be when I was a little boy, is pretty much gone by the boards. When I went to Time Magazine right out of journalism school, we had competition for, I don't know, seemed as if it must have been 60 bureaus all over the world. You know, there were five or six in Africa, and you were limited only by the fact that you didn't speak a foreign language. I remember I had to cut my expectations down because I was sort of poor in French and more or less monolingual. But the man who could speak seven languages, Henry Muller, he went from being my copy boy to being managing editor in 14 years.
Well, so you're worried about
the media. But it was a
whole
different world in those days.
I'm the eternal optimist, and you are not the eternal pessimist, but you're critical.
I'm very pessimistic.
And of course, I would argue, or I would just say, suggest to you, or I'd a question, whether or not you think that people today are taken as not just the elite, but that a broad category of Americans, I'd suggest, are better informed today than they were 20, 25 years ago. And on the basis of the taking into account the decline of the daily newspapers, both power, commitment to deliver information, and our interest in reading. But golly, you've got, you know, four or five different news channels plus network news coverage, plus you've got the computer and the internet, which young people are using to get information. You got a whole broad competitive situation in providing different sources of information. So it's hard to keep a secret if you're in government today, isn't it? Aren't I right about that?
It's not really true. But it's not censorship we're talking about. Well, there are two separate problems here. You know, I mean, I would totally reject that there's anything really helpful in terms of information occurring now in broadcasting. I think when they ran Bill Moyers off for being too radical, you know, a moderate Baptist minister from East Texas, whom I've admired all my life, when he became too hot, you know, that was sort of the end. I mean, he was the greatest broadcast journalist of his day. And when they actually got rid of Dan Rather and half his producers because of that, you know, that show about the president's service and, you know, and during the Vietnam, there's not a whole lot happening really that's helpful at all in broadcasting. Now, in terms of censorship, you're right that the internet has opened up the world of information to 1,000 voices. The problem, finally, though, when it comes to informing yourself, is that it takes a great deal of financial commitment to get your people to where the news is being made, to get them around the barriers that governments and the military and some throw up. And although there are a great many people well worth reading on the internet that you can't read anywhere else, the number of people who have the resources to go and get those stories that the Los Angeles Times and Time Magazine and Newsweek and, you know, and then, so the ones that they used to pay the money to get, the number of people who can get to where those stories are and bring them back alive, very few. And the trouble with so many of these sites that you read, you can't really vouch for the truth of them. You can read 100, and you can hope that when you read 100, you get a broad cross-section, and maybe if you're a very wise person, you can winnow out the truth. But it was true at one time that the very best journalists making the very best salaries and kind of adhering to the highest principles could be found in a few places. You know, I mean, it was a brief time. I'll tell you that. I mean, I think it started with Edward R. Murrow in the 30s, and it died when anchor people started making $5 million a year in the 70s, you know, after Watergate and so on. But there was a period when you really could rely on certain sources, and it's going to be very hard to say what those sources might be 10 years from now or even as we speak.
Mm.
I mean, these are problems that you can see more clearly from inside the media than outside. I mean, I know a great many people with gifts and the desire to be heard and to investigate these stories. But investigative reporters, is incredibly expensive. Foreign bureaus are incredibly expensive. So we get less and less of both.
Listen, then. Are you hopeful about anything?
I'm just hopeful that at some point in this country, the whole ethos will turn around so that, you know, people don't start thinking about how much money they're going to be able to make when they're in the seventh grade and they go back to that kind of dopey idealism that we had back in the 60s where, you know, when I graduated from college in 1966. And I know this sounds arrogant today, and I know a lot of young people will just, you know, they'll assume that I came from vast wealth, which I did not. But we had no notion that making money was was an important thing to do. Although we were surrounded, you know, by a lot of people whose families did have it, our idea was that you had to make a difference, that you were a privileged person. This is what John Kennedy said, you know, famously, a person who did grow up with born with a silver spoon in his mouth. But he said, if you're to those whom much is given, much is required. And we really believed that. I mean, that sounds infantile almost.
Now, I ask you if you're hopeful. Are you hopeful genuinely?
I'm hopeful that this kind of thinking, that this kind of attitude will somehow be resurrected.
And do you have a real...
The total materialistic life is not taking people anywhere, and that people should go back and try to rearrange things in this country so that education becomes important.
Are you optimistic
politics
that might
become
happen?
Honest.
Are you optimistic that that might happen?
No.
So you're not really hopeful in the
but
same...
But I haven't lost hope.
All right, good. Well, it's been great talking to you, Hal Crowther, about your book, and I'm going to try to persuade you just now to come back and talk some more about your book. In the meantime, thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.
at work, in the car. News Talk 1360, WCHL, Chapel Hill, Carrboroughs, News Talk and Tar Heel Station.